This is file number 2, cycle number 2. Today's date is September 21st, 2015. This is Jean McMillan, and I am interviewing Margie Vale. She's going to talk about many things, including her family background, Mount Riga, the cemetery at Mount Riga, Julia Petit, Dr. Clark, and some of the committees that she's on, as well as being Registrar of Voters. We'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
My name is Margaret Claire Vale. Claire for the county in Ireland, not the French saint.
All right. And your maiden name was O'Brien?
O'Brien, yes.
Your birthday?
My birthday is July 8, 1944.
And where were you born?
I was born in New York City in a hospital that my parents referred to as the French Hospital, I believe because it was an order of French nuns who ran the hospital.
And your parents' names, please.
My father's name was Robert Henry O'Brien. My mother's name was Louise Crosby McCabe O'Brien.
And did you have or do you have siblings?
I do. I have an oldest sister who is deceased. Her name was Elizabeth Crosby O'Brien. And then she married. It became Musaviras. She divorced and married again, and it was Wernstrom. She is buried in the Mount Riga Cemetery. My brother Robert is still alive. He's Robert Ambrose O'Brien, and he lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. I have a sister, Mariah Louisa, as she was named on her birth certificate, spelled Maria Louisa, and she was always called Mary Louise. Today, she calls herself Mariah with an H at the end. She lives in Toronto, Canada.
And what is your educational background?
I have a master's degree in pastoral ministry.
And where did you get the degree from?
Oh, I got it at Seton Hall University in New Jersey, Orange, New Jersey.
Now, I'm going to check some family background. Your parents, I have their names. Your grandparents were
Pauline
Crosby Wells McCabe.
Yes.
Was she sometimes called Polly?
Always.
And she married Ambrose Farrell
McCabe.
Great grandparents. Your great grandmother ran a boarding house in Brewster?
She did. Caroline Carmen Crosby.
And she had a boarder that was
she
there.
She did.
And his name was?
Sam Church.
Okay, got that straight. There were three women that were very good friends on the mountain, I believe.
Yes.
Could you tell me those three ladies?
Yes. Maisie Griggs, my grandmother, Polly, and Harriet Warner.
Was Maisie Griggs related to the Steve Griggs that I know?
Yes, yes. She, I believe, was his grandmother.
Makes sense, okay. Hattie Warner, would she be grandmother to any of the Warners that I've met?
No, I don't think so. She would be great-grandmother, I believe. She was, I believe she was grandmother to Donald Warner.
Donald Tishner or Donald Judson?
Oh, this is where I always get in
trouble.
Oh,
me too. Oh, all right. That's all right. We'll go with that.
She was married to old Judge Warner, so I think that's Donald J.
Yeah.
Then there was Donald T., who mm-hmm. was a probate judge, and then there's Donald J., who was the lawyer in Sharon. I think it's Donald J. that she was.
Great. And that was the older judge.
Right.
You have a camp on the Upper Lake.
I do. We do, my family and I. My brother and I inherited from my mother, Louise McCabe O'Brien, the camp, along with my sister Mariah. And Mariah, there was family land in Litchfield, so Mariah chose the land in Litchfield, and my brother and I split the leasehold on Mount Raga, and we share it equally. So I have one set of cabins, and he has another.
Does your set of cabins have a name?
No, we're all wish come true. That's kind of complicated.
But I understand about that part of it.
Okay, so we're just called the Vail Camp.
Okay. And you have a garden up there.
I do.
You're the only camp that I saw that had a garden. That's why I remember it. There was a story about how Polly actually got wish come true.
Yes.
Could you tell that story, please?
Sure. She was a friend of Hattie's, her cousin, actually, and because Harriet Hattie was a Wells who had married a Warner, and Polly used to visit her in Litchfield when she lived in Litchfield, grew up in Litchfield, Hattie did, and so they were very friendly, and Hattie married Judge Warner, and he had a fishing camp on the upper lake of Mount Raga. He was involved in the consolidation of all the pieces of the iron, former iron industry, to try and create a summer community. And he was interested in getting other people to buy this consolidation with him. My grandmother, Polly, wanted very much to have a place there. She asked her mother, Caroline Carmen Crosby, who was married to Major Frank Wells, if they could buy a share of a third. I don't know. It wasn't originally conceived as a third, I don't think, but a share into this. And my great-grandmother was reluctant to do this. Polly was soon to be married, and the boarder who lived with my great-grandmother and my great-grandfather overheard this discussion, or else Polly asked him to intercede for her. I'm not quite sure how, but he went to my great-grandmother and said that he would purchase this share and it would be a wedding present for her and for her soon-to-be husband, who was Ambrose Farrell McCabe. And they were very, very happy, and Judge Warner gave them permission to have a camp on the upper lake. He had, when he was setting out this thing, he had kind of reserved the upper lake only for himself, and then other people could take places at the village part of the mountain at the lower lake. So she was very, very pleased with this, and they chose the site, which is still the site of the what we call the main camp. And they named that whole camp. It was basically a three-acre parcel. They named it Wish Come True.
And it is lovely.
It is.
I have seen that. It is lovely.
Now it is broken, divided between my mother's children and my two uncles, Ambrose and Spaulding. So they are both deceased, but their children, my first cousins, all share with us the leasehold of Wish Come True, Inc. Wow. As direct descendants. And the Ambrose Church McCabe, named for Sam Church, family, has formed a corporation that's called Our Camp Corp. If you were to look on the tax records, that's how you would find their buildings named. And then my youngest, the youngest uncle, youngest brother of my mother's, Spalding, was Lyman Austin Spalding McCabe, named for his father's law partner, Lyman Austin Spalding, who was a bachelor, never married, and this was their naming their youngest child for him.
And that is
Mike McCabe's father, and Lindy McCabe G's father. And we're actually sitting in the living room made by Spalding for his family.
Really?
This was originally, the house just about ended here. It was a little, small little house that they purchased during World War II. He was in the Pacific, so it was years later when he came back. They moved here, and then in the 60s, he built the larger room over here.
And I just want to interject that we are now at 100 Bunker Hill. We are not on Mount Rigat.
That's correct.
You, as a young lady, met Julia Petit.
I did.
Where was she living when you met her?
She was living up on Selick Hill at the corner property. I think of it as the corner property that would be to take you down to Lincoln City Road. I don't really know if it's called Lincoln City right from the top of Selick Hill, but there was a small house, old house, beautiful house. I think it's still there. And I was taken there by my uncle, Frank McCabe, and with my cousin, Martha McCabe, and we were there to visit with Miss Petit. He had questions for her because he had started an organization. I believe it had started by then, but maybe it was later actually founded. He called it the Mount Raga Educational and Historical Society. And what he wanted to do was preserve the history of Mount Raga and keep all of the records and documentation safe. I was a young girl. I was probably 10 or 11 when we visited there. And when I was in my mid-20s, my husband, who is an attorney, was asked by Frank to work with this foundation. So I don't know if it was really founded in the 50s or if he only gathered the information and then incorporated it in the 60s. And Charlie would be able to tell you how long it existed. It then, for some reason, oh, I'm sorry.
You were telling me about this
the corporation. Yes, it was called the Foundation, I believe. And his idea was to fund it. And maybe he couldn't get the funding. I really don't know. That's another question for Charlie. The legal things, I was having babies and busy at the
time. You were busy with other things.
But he took me to see, and my cousin, to see Miss Petit. And so I remember, really, what I remember most was a wonderful woman sitting in a chair, almost like a Windsor chair, not a padded or upholstered chair.
It would be a wooden chair.
And there was, it was warm, it was summertime, but I seem to remember either a source of heat, too. It was very warm inside, and of course she was very elderly, so it would make sense.
Oh, sure.
And We had refreshments, which were important to me,
of course,
age 11.
Of course.
And I remember sitting and listening and Uncle Frank talking to Miss Petit, and then she engaged us. She told us that she had been a school teacher, that she wanted to know what grades we were in and what we studied and what we knew about where we were. She talked about her father being the superintendent of the ironworks, and she talked about the freeze-up or the break in the
Salamander.
The salamander. And how dramatic it was, and the calling of everybody to try and help. She talked about what the mountain was like when she was growing up, about the school and the store. And my uncle, at the time we were visiting, my uncle's cottage on Mount Raga, which is called Daniel's Cottage, had been the store, had been a store there. And he had a lot of artifacts that were from the days of the store. And he was very interested in her memories of what the store looked like, because the building had been added on. Mm-hmm. My great-grandmother, this goes back a little bit to my great-grandmother, who had not wanted to have my grandmother move to Mount Raga in the summer, mm-hmm. gave in when she realized that her grandchildren were going to all summer there. And so she and her husband bought Daniel's Cottage outright. They didn't buy it through the Mount Raga Incorporated group. They bought a farmer's land, and I guess the farmer's name was Daniels, because my uncle was very precise, and he always called it Daniel's Cottage.
With an S.
Yes. And that piece of land incorporated their house, their what would be their summer house, the old schoolhouse, lots of acreage flowing west and a little bit south down off the mountain to where the old ore road to Millerton went, the easiest transport for the iron ore. And also, I believe, the farmhouse that was later occupied by the Collins, who were very, very good friends of the family.
Daniel's Cottage, is it now the Whittier Camp?
Yes.
Got that right. Before we go on to the schoolhouse, can you give me a physical description of Miss Petit?
My impression of her was that she was a large woman without being corpulent. She was just
Big, sturdy.
And of course she was old. Mm-hmm. And so she was sitting down and wrapped with
a shawl.
Not a shawl so much as just something cotton over her. So I couldn't really
see her
tell
figure.
You what her physique
she,
was like.
She wasn't petite.
Not at all.
Ah,
no.
Okay.
She wasn't petite, but she was not large. She was just sturdy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best description I can have. And her hair was pulled up in kind of a like Aunt Bee from just a little top knot kind mm-hmm. of thing mm-hmm. on top of her head. And
was she wearing glasses?
You know, I can't really say that she was. I have a feeling there might have been glasses near her.
Could be.
But I remember crinkly skin. Mm-hmm. and lively eyes.
What color were they? Can you remember?
I don't remember that. Okay. I seem to remember dark, but everything was a little dark.
In there.
And her hair was mostly white, but I think gray would be the way I'd describe it, almost steely.
Mm.
I'm not sure about that.
Good job. Thank you. That's
I'm not
great.
Sure about that. And her skin was very weathered, as anyone who lives outside and lives that number of years would be.
The schoolhouse. Now, it's on the property of Frank McCabe, but it was moved.
It was moved. But it was moved, and then it burned.
Yes.
What is currently called the schoolhouse is not the schoolhouse. Yeah.
Were you ever in the schoolhouse when it was... not a sleeping cabin, but the building still had the maps in it?
No. I don't remember that. It was always used, I think, all the time in my memory, it was always used as a summer cabin.
Sleeping cabin.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was destroyed in 1985.
Gas
explosion. All right. Tell me about... I'm going to go to the cemetery first, and then I'll pick up on Dr. Clark.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the Mount Riga Cemetery. There are two. There's the old one, and then there's the new one.
Right.
Are you responsible, the cemetery board, are you responsible for both?
No, we're not. We're only responsible for the new one. And I just got a phone call from Jane...
Sillery? Yeah, she's interested in...
She's interested in the old one, and I returned her call, but I haven't heard back from her. We have a real interest in the old one and in maintaining the old one, but when the new one was incorporated, it was made pretty clear that the old one is one of the town cemeteries.
It's one of my responsibilities.
Right.
That's what I thought. How many members are on the Riga Cemetery Board?
Hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4. I believe there are 6 of us.
And can you name any of them?
Sure. Rick Blaker is the president. He is married to Virginia Wells, mm-hmm. Blaker. And then there's Mary DePasquale, who was Mary Schlesinger, now DePasquale. And Lindy McCabe G. Mm-hmm. And her name is spelled L-I-N-D-E. She is named for a German Lindy.
I've done Mike McCabe.
Right, okay. And then, Fran was on it, but I think she's since resigned. I'm not sure. She could still be on the board. I know her son, Robbie, is now the superintendent, which means he's in charge of the burials and stuff.
Are we talking Fran Miller?
Fran Miller's son, Robbie.
I wish I'd known that when I met him. Okay. All right.
Okay. And there's, I'm forgetting, there's somebody.
You're on it.
I'm on it. And somebody else comes to the meetings. Gordon Chapman was on it and could still be on it, but... is no longer superintendent. He turned that over to Robbie Miller.
Okay.
Trish Griggs comes to the meeting. I believe she's officially on the board. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can... I said Chapman.
That's good.
I'm assuming that Gordon Chapman is the son of Jim and Kay Chapman?
That's correct. And she, of course, was a Lippincott. And Harry Wells, my great uncle, son of Carolyn Carmen and Major Frank, married a Lippincott. Her name was Caroline Lippincott, and then she married Harry Wells. So,
is this the Lippincott of Lippincott books?
I believe so.
Okay.
But that's what brought the Chapmans to Mount Raga.
Ah, that's
she was the Lippincott, and so Kay Chapman was a Lippincott.
Mm-hmm.
She was the niece of Caroline Wells.
I will do extremely well if I get all of genealogy sorted, but I'll get it. I'll get it. When do you meet?
We meet the first Sunday in October every year, and we'd love to have you join us if you'd like. We meet around 9 o'clock in the morning. As soon as I get my notice from the president, I will send you an invitation.
I would very much like to attend the cemetery meeting.
Okay.
I truly would.
Okay.
And you said something about mapping. You're mapping the new cemetery?
We are. What we are trying to do is basically, we have a map of the new cemetery, which was done on a computer grid by Gordon Chapman, and it is tremendously helpful. But when you translate that to the ground, there seem to be some difficulties.
Yes.
And so what we are trying to do is figure out a way to use modern surveying technique to get these plots regularized, I would call them.
Yeah.
And then there are those of us on the board who would like to put corner markers on our plots. And we can't do that until
you have it regularized.
The corners.
Right.
Yes.
Perfect. Oh, that's very helpful. Now, I'm going on to Dr. Clark. I've heard some stories about him, but you have a rather painful story about your eye and marshmallows.
Not my eye, my sister.
Your sister's eye.
My sister Mariah. I was, oh gosh, I guess I was 6 or 7. The occasion was the birthday, the so-called birthday, of our family pony.
Chiefy.
Chiefy, yes.
How do you spell Chiefy's name?
Well, I'm not sure we ever spelt his name.
Well, I'm spelling it two E's.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay.
I would have spelt it I-E, but if you ask my brother, he might have spelt it with a Y, so who knows? Chiefy was really my brother's responsibility and my brother's pony.
Mm-hmm.
He was a rascal. Terrible rascal. He also was very old. I don't know where he came from. I have a feeling my Uncle Frank gave him to my mother. My Uncle Frank and Aunt Mary Lee used to have horses where they lived in Albany or Rensselaer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling that Chiefy got too old, and so he was given away.
Uh-huh.
Chiefy lived with us for lots of years. Robbie can tell you more than anybody. But on Mount Raga, he kept the grass down on the lower lawn between where the superintendent's house that we call Castanook and the road up from the village.
Oh.
There was a field in there.
Yes. Yes.
And Chiefy, that was his pasture, basically.
Okay.
And one summer, really, I have no idea of the impetus, but I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't my Uncle Ambrose and his wife Betty's impetus. It was decided to have a Chiefy's birthday party. And so it was established that this was Chiefy's birthday, and we had a big it was for the whole mountain. It was a big cookout. It was in his pasture, and there was a stone wall that separated the lawn sloped down from Castanook, as it still does. There was an artesian well, which my mother had dug during World War II at some time, because she had a victory garden up there and kept chickens.
I've heard about the chicken house.
Yes. And so down below that in the pasture was where we all congregated. And there was hot dogs and sodas, which were very uncommon for us as children. Mm-hmm. We never
drank
soft drink.
But that, yeah.
And big tubs, galvanized tubs with ice and beer in them for the grown-ups, and a marshmallow roast. And this is where Dr. Clark's expertise comes into play. My sister never liked burned marshmallows.
Uh-huh.
She only liked them golden brown. And some of us were not as fastidious.
Particular. Okay.
And so there were a whole bunch of kids. All of my cousins and I were all around. And I think we all remember this event. I know one of, I think of her as my cousin, but she's really a friend. We were talking about this summer. Whenever I see children roasting marshmallows, I get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that somebody who had a flaming marshmallow turned from the fire, and it hit my sister in her eye. And a very dear friend of my mother's, who was not my aunt, but we always called her aunt, scooped up ice water out of one of these tubs and threw it at her eye, just instinctively, mm-hmm. to put out the burning sugar, burning marshmallow. And people, there was a general comment of, oh, you shouldn't have done that. It should have been butter. Put butter on a burn. But my mother took my sister up to Dr. Clark, and he said that my Aunt Peggy had done just the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it stopped the sugar from
burning.
And my sister then had to go to an eye specialist, but there was absolutely no damage to her eye.
Oh, how wonderful.
And she still sees from it perfectly well, although it's getting older now.
Yes. He is some relation to Ray Bartlett?
Yes, Ray Bartlett would be his grandson.
Okay.
I hope that there were two boys, and well, let's go back. There was Dr. Clark, and Dr. Clark had a daughter,
Mary,
who married a Bartlett.
Mm-hmm.
And
Ray would be her son.
Ray was, I think the father's name was Ray, too, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mary married Ray Bartlett. But then there were two boys from that, and that is Ray and Bill. And Ray is still alive.
Yeah.
I believe he's the older.
Yeah.
And Bill is deceased.
Because Alice Combs has said she's going to write to Ray Bartlett because he has a genealogy chart.
He does.
And that was one of her goals, was to do that for me.
And the thing about his genealogy chart, which we have up at our cabin, there are some errors in it. He did a masterful job,
mm-hmm.
but I shouldn't say errors. There are things that were not added to it that should have been to clarify things.
Yeah.
But when you get that chart, if you can get a whole brand new one, because ours has got coffee stains and baby stains.
Yeah, all the good stuff.
All the stuff, all okay. over it.
All righty.
We'll look at it and try and
oh, good.
Straighten it out.
Good.
tennis courts. There are three tennis courts, correct?
Right.
And there is a tournament?
There is. Now, there are only one. There's only one set of tennis courts now. It holds two courts.
And that's behind Cassinock.
And that is behind Cassinock. Somewhere near there was a tennis court. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly where. My Uncle Spaulding is the one who resurrected that tennis court.
Ah.
Decided that we should have tennis again. We were all, my generation was about, Mike was probably 14, I was there for 13, somewhere in there, 12 or 13, mm-hmm. and the parents decided that we should have tennis court. So they pretty much tried to locate where the old one was, but I don't believe it's in the same spot. The other two tennis courts on Mount Raga, when my mother was growing up, so that would have been in the teens and 20s, there was one at the Bartlett, what is now the Bartlett camp, at the Clark camp, right in the middle between the lower lake and the upper lake. So you might call that a mid-mountain tennis court. And then the upper lake, my grandparents had one at Wish Come True, Camp Wish Come True. Mm-hmm. And that was a clay court. I believe they were all three clay courts.
Okay. Tell me about the public beach at the lower lake.
The public beach, what we now refer to as the public beach, was called Ostrander's when I was a girl.
Yeah.
And it was because there was an Ostrander's
house.
And in my mom's time, you went to Ostrander's and they had a farm because mm-hmm. she talks mm-hmm. about getting vegetables at Ostrander's. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ostrander's, and I'm not exactly sure how this connection came, but Henrietta Cole, Hetty Cole was, I'm not sure she was an Ostrander, but no, she was a Hotchkiss, I think. But somehow the Ostranders and the Hotchkiss family owned that property or purchased that property because for years Sid Cole and Hazel lived there every summer. And Sid and Hazel never had children, mm-hmm. but she had a niece who was Sis Brewer, Dr. Ed Brewer's wife. Mm-hmm. First wife, I think.
Yeah, first wife.
Dr. Brewer and his wife spent, in my childhood, this would be the 50s and 60s, they spent the month of June there. And then Sid and Hazel would spend the rest of the summer there.
And the camp that they were at would have been called Camp Ozone.
Yes.
Got that one. Okay. Where is the public beach on the lower lake?
The public beach is between...
It's not where the dam is.
No. That's further. Called Cassinock Beach, really, if they call it anything. Mm-hmm. But it is where the swing set is and where the water runoff goes. That would be, let's say, Cassinock Beach. Mm-hmm. Then farther up the road, the old road, which used to proceed right along the shore of the lake, the next thing you would come to would be where Ostrander's was. And that clearing where Ostrander's was is now the public beach.
I have been there. I have seen that. I Okay.
And
it's on the left as you're going up that way.
Yes, it is. But if you, we'll have to get you out on the lake, because if you go by water, you can see where the old road was. The old road was built with slag and cinders from the forge, and it used to hurt mightily to walk on that patch of it.
I can believe it. I had a cinder driveway when I was growing up. Don't fall off your bicycle.
No, and we would run that last section because, and when we were children, it was always called the guest beach. It was called the guest beach, and anyone from Salisbury was welcome to come and use it, and still is. Then beyond the guest beach was Ozone, Camp Ozone. And that's what I was talking about with Sid and Hazel mm-hmm. and the Brewers. But they were all, I believe Ostranders was in that stretch. So I...
When did permits come in for using the guest beach?
Oh, that that was much later. I would say it was the 70s or early 80s. I was actually, my cousin Lindy G and I were asked as a committee because we were living, raising our children there all summer long. And by that time, my Uncle Spaulding mm-hmm. had built the new road that
yep.
where you go up the Mount Washington Road slightly and then curve in, and it comes back to the lake on the other side of Ozone, Camp Ozone. So after they built that new high road, you might say.
Rather than the low road.
It was much better for the lake, of course,
oh, sure.
because people weren't driving by. But it allowed entrance into the beach off that road. Mm-hmm. And you could continue on that road and go to the campsites that were managed first by David Brzee and then by his son Danny. And there were campsites along that road. And
yes.
some people started making informal campsites or places where they would just beach their boat. And it was felt that it was eroding some of the soil into the lake and that we had to formalize where the camping spots were. So I would say it was late 70s or probably late 70s, mid to late 70s, yes.
And how many permits are given?
Oh, well, now, as many as needed. Everybody can get a permit. All you have to do is request one. At the original time, it was thinking that there wasn't parking for all the vehicles. And so they looked at how many people usually came up, mm-hmm. and I think it was something like 100, they said, they're first come, first serve.
Yeah.
And then that didn't work because there were a lot more people who would like the permit, but so they switched the concept, and by the time my daughter was at the gate, so to speak, checking people in, she was a teenager, and the board established a rule that only the first 25 could come in because that's how many cars you could honestly pack in there.
Good point.
But even so, I can't imagine 25 cars.
All right, we're going to come off the mountain now.
Okay.
And I'm going to ask you about Owl's Kitchen, the Town Beautification Committee, and we'll end up with being registrar.
Okay.
Owl's Kitchen. Does it have a new name?
It does. Wow, I hope I remember. The Northwest Corner Food Pantry. I'm pretty sure I got that right.
When did it start?
I don't know. when Owl's Kitchen was established. My neighbor Sue Marl would know.
I will ask her. She's on my list.
Okay. It was established, I believe, by Penny Grant and Lottie Gerstel.
Yep.
And maybe Barbara Pogue.
That sounds right.
And, oh, there was a wonderful woman, Jean, from Cornwall, who was head of it for years. When I first came back to Salisbury and moved back after we retired, Jean was the chairman, I think. I think she's deceased now.
How many volunteer?
Now?
Now.
Oh, you would have to ask Sue.
Okay.
I'm a small fry. I only work there.
Well, what do you do when you work there?
Well, I actually go once a week to a farm in Cornwall, Gordon Ridgway's farm, and pick up fresh vegetables. So it goes from sometime in May, whenever Gordon says he has enough vegetables for me to come get, and goes until usually until the end of October, he has things for me to pick up. And I go every Friday and pick up at the farm supplies and bring them over and deliver them to the pantry.
Where is the pantry?
The pantry is in a house adjacent to the rectory at St. Mary's Church.
And there's something special about John Borden.
Oh, John Borden is wonderful. John comes every Friday morning with the ladies who really run the pantry. They collect on Friday mornings together, and they organize. They decide what's going to be given out that week, and they make up lists for all the volunteers, and they uncrate food and stack shelves, and that's done every Friday morning. I used to do that quite frequently, but now they have a steady group that does it. And one reason they don't really need as much help is because John comes every Friday morning, and he is the muscle and backbone whole group. He is wonderful.
When do they actually pass out the food?
Every other Friday night and every Saturday morning, with very few exceptions. Christmas and Thanksgiving, they do ahead of time so people have their food. And they work with the local radio station and the food drive that they always have to get turkeys. Mm-hmm. And they also ask for donations at that time so they can purchase. And they do special meals, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and I believe Easter. And those special meals, sometimes they have special pickup times, but other than that, it's Friday and Saturday. And then they do a wonderful thing in the fall, which my grandchildren have helped with. They do school supplies. They ask the Salisbury Central, and they might have expanded it, but I think they've kept it to Salisbury Central School, for the teachers, for their list of recommended supplies for each grade. And then the people who ordinarily use the food pantry can say what grades their children are in. And then they get
school supplies.
A bag full of the needed supplies.
Why do you do this? Why do you work with Owl's Kitchen? I didn't mean to throw you a curve.
No.
obviously you believe in helping other people.
I do. I believe it's our obligation.
It is. It is our obligation to help others in any way that we can.
And I think it's one of the joys of living in the country is that we live in a small enough community to be able to take care of the people who live in it.
Mm-hmm. We should take care of one another.
We should. And I hate the word should. We can, and we do. And I suppose it is an obligation, but I hope it's a gift.
It's more of a gift.
Yes.
A gift to help others.
Right. And I think this community, it concerns me, actually, because this is slopping over into my registrar job, but because I am involved in creating the ballot for the year, mm-hmm. I can tell you that there are a lot of empty spots on the ballot. And to me, it's not a healthy sign of the community. It means that people have stopped having an interest in the welfare of the community. And it goes beyond the welfare of people. I think that's paramount. But we have the welfare of the environment, mm-hmm. of the educational community. Mm-hmm. There are two empty spots on the school board. And that, to me, is unfathomable that people are not concerned with the education of all of the children of Salisbury.
They also realize how much work it takes.
It takes
a tremendous amount.
It does. I would say the other board that is true on most especially is planning and zoning. And planning and zoning was not always in Salisbury. I think it came in the 70s sometime.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure.
Probably.
But it is what helps us to keep our community civil by having a place to go to say this is too much or this is too little or we need more. It's what keeps us a society of neighbors.
Oh, I like that, rather than strangers. I like that. And the Town Beautification Committee is sort of on the same line to make where we live attractive.
Yes, it is. It really fell to a group of people who said, well, the Salisbury Garden Club has folded.
It did.
And so if it's folded, we need to do something to make sure that we're still planting the pots and mm-hmm. doing something. And so it's really a very loosely constructed group of women. We'd love to have some men who would like to help too, who gather right now three times a year, in the spring, in the summer, and in the fall. And we set out plants in the pots down along Salisbury and Lakeville Main Street. And then we also do a few extra things like the post office window box and the boxes. They're not window boxes, but by the town hall that are on the steps of this town hall.
And by the library?
And by the, no, the library, I must do their own.
Okay.
We'd happily do the library, but we do one in front of the Academy building, a couple mm-hmm. of them,
yep.
and in front of the post office. And now they've ventured down Academy Street. There's one in front of what used to be called At Home in the Country, but I hear that they're going to close their doors.
Oh.
Soon. That's too bad.
How many women, approximately?
There's probably eight. The leader, I consider them the leaders, Barbara Nichols and Chani Wells. They are the real organizers and get the rest of us to show up with our trowels and gloves.
All right. I think we're going to end up with registrar.
Registrar voters.
Yes,
well,
please. How did you get the job?
Somebody asked me.
And you said yes.
And I said yes, which has gotten me into trouble my whole life, saying yes. But this job, I really did only because my husband talked me into it. He said, come on, somebody needs to do it, and you like it.
That makes a difference. It really does. You have to like what you're doing.
Right.
Were there any specific qualifications at the time that you were asked?
No, there should have been, but there weren't. I think, to tell you the truth, Dick Walsh had the job before me, mm-hmm. and he and Trish were hoping to move to North Carolina, and he was just desperate to find somebody. So I think that's how I ended up with the job. I knew rudimentary computer, still do, and he said that was better than my counterpart, which was true. The Republican registrar didn't know computer at all, mm-hmm. so that he felt comfortable in that, and it was a very simple system at the time. And then I had worked an election or two. And so I guess the members of the party thought that I wasn't going to miscount.
Good point. Do you have training that you have to go to now?
I do, yes. Actually, in 2 days, we start an 8-part certification process that was just enacted by the legislature this mm-hmm. year. And it will... it'll cost the town a pretty penny, about $1,600 per registrar, and then also for our deputies to be certified. But I believe it is a very good thing. It will regularize throughout the state what people know about what their job is. And I can tell you from our most recent registrar conference just at the beginning of this month, mm-hmm. September, that there are some registrars who are very fearful of this certification process.
I
think they've been out of school a long time and they hear tests and they get very worried.
It's scary.
But I honestly believe it was designed with the best interests of the state and state elections in mind, and I think we'll all get through it swimmingly.
Of course. Of course. If you've got a positive attitude, it carries you a long way.
That's right.
What do you actually do?
Well, we actually register people to vote. That's where the registrar part comes in. Our official title is Registrar and Elections Administrator. And so the registration involves keeping current the list of registered voters. That involves a ongoing computer, making sure your paper records are the same as your corresponding computerized records. And that is actually done in the winter every year, from January through May. During that time, we have what we call the canvas. And we can use several different methods to ascertain whether people are still living where they say they're living,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that their name is the same, and that they're still interested in being on the voting rolls. And so that involves some detective work, which is
sure.
kind of fun.
Uh-huh.
And it also involves a lot of following of state statutes. So there are very prescribed ways that we must write to people and ask them if they are still living at the same address. And if we get no answer, then we have another statutory requirement of keeping them, holding them in abeyance for 4 years in what we call an inactive list. They would, if they came back and said, oh, no, I just didn't answer my postcard, but I'm here, then we can reactivate them. But if they stay that way for 4 years, they get out.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
And the other is elections administration, which we're just now beginning to plan for. My co-registrar and I will name the moderator and our poll workers soon. And we will then start our statutory required activities. We have to check our voting tabulators. We have to, with the town clerk, approve the ballot, which we've done, actually. We just did last week. And then we have to keep track of who might be write-ins. And this year, there might be some, hopefully. We are still looking for people who might be interested in taking some of these board positions that are vacant at the moment. Okay. And then we have a very long, about 15 and a half or 16 hour day in November. And that is the most grueling and the most energizing day of the whole year for this job.
I can believe it.
It is truly an exciting day and full of
energy.
I seem to have more energy at the end of the day than I did when I wake up at 4:30 in the morning.
I wish you'd bottle it and send it to me. All right. Before we close the interview, is there anything either about Mount Riga or the other things that I've asked you that you would like to add that I haven't covered?
Oh, my goodness, you've been so thorough. Well, I guess I would say that I see something changing in Mount Riga, which is sad but understandable. And that is that my children and the children of a few others on Mount Riga are probably the last ones that will ever get to spend their entire summer on the mountain. We are still a summer community, but when I was growing up and when my children were growing up, we moved up as soon as school was out. In fact, when we lived in Sharon, we moved up before school was out. And we spent all summer, and we came down in October when it got too hard to do homework by kerosene lamp. Or at least they said it did. And so I have a tremendous affection for the fact that living up on the mountain, as some have done, like the Millers spent a year there, and Roger and Ann Williams back a while ago, one of Alice's relatives.
Yep.
Living there year-round was always something that Charlie and I thought we would do, and I think we've now checked that off. It's not on the bucket list anymore. We have winter camped up there, and we enjoyed it when we were younger. Our last time to do that was 2000. We spent New Year's Eve up there with a whole bunch of people and had a wonderful night and went out on the lake, and it was a beautiful, beautiful occasion. But I think that those days are gone for us. Our children are very strongly connected to the mountain and to their friendships there. And I hope that in future generations, even with part-time coming to the mountain, that they will build that sense of community and belonging. It goes a little bit farther than that, into the ability to think through a problem and make do, or to not have exactly what you need, so you create another way to do something. There's still a lot of card games and board games and things that children can come, if they come for 2 weeks or a week, mm-hmm. can participate in and enjoy. But that whole sense of the fact that acres is your backyard, and you're free to roam, you're free to swim, to canoe, to berry pick, to hike, without any parent really being concerned about you. Mm-hmm. You're just gone.
Yeah.
And that freedom, and also the, I guess the responsibility that comes with that freedom, mm-hmm. staying safe, staying mostly sensible, comes with an appreciation of the land, and with the appreciation of the land, I'm going to get teary again, comes a feeling of responsibility.
And we're going to leave it there because I don't want you to be teary. Thank you so much.
I'm teary because I should have been.